I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of May. Mondays at 1 o'clock means all things political. And our guest this hour is Jamel Bowie, Slate staff writer who covers politics, policy, and race. He has written many important articles recently, and he was in Baltimore last week. Here are some of his headlines. We know what killed Freddie Gray. He also wrote about Hillary's impressive criminal justice speech, the deep, troubling roots of Baltimore's decline, Bush's millions breaking fundraising, and says that he is doing that, breaking the record, so why doesn't that scare anybody? Bill Clinton's high price and why Hillary must turn her back on parts of her husband's political legacy to win in 2016. Scott Walker's anti-immigration epiphany. Obama's gift to Hillary Clinton. Mr. Runner-up. It's not that Senator Marco Rubio can't win. It's that he's almost no one's first choice for the top job. And the progressive impersonator Martin O'Malley wants to be the liberal alternative to Hillary Clinton. It's a good strategy, he says, for an actual liberal. Today we have more Republicans entering the presidential race. There are going to be so many Republicans who are running for president. So those are a few of the items in our agenda today, and we welcome you to broaden the conversation however you would like. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your comments there. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. And we're delighted to have Jamel with us this hour of the program. He's just written some really good articles. I would urge you to go to Slate and or look up his name on Google, and you'll find so much that he has written. Jamel, thank you very much for being with us again. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. So you were in Baltimore last week. What a difference a week makes with Friday's announcement and the celebrations that took place over the weekend. Friday morning, Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced the results of the autopsy, charged six police officers, and all of a sudden there was celebration in the streets in Baltimore. Were her findings surprising to you, Jamel?
They were. I was not expecting the state's attorney's office to file any charges, and that's mainly because there's not really a history of charges being filed in these sorts of cases. Typically, in sort of police violence cases, the officers in question, their use of force is found justified, and that's mainly because there's just a very wide and broad level of sort of support for using force by police officers. It basically takes a very egregious violation of procedure for any wrongdoing to be suggested or even found. So the fact that this was the conclusion, I think, supports the intuitions of many people on the ground that what happened with Freddie Gray was misconduct at the least. And, you know, it shows how much I think that the Baltimore City government is responding to that concern.
Mm-hmm. And yet, as she reiterated, he was wrongly detained by police, fatally injured under their care. No crime had been committed by Freddie Gray. No crime. And yet he lost his life.
Right, that's what's so outrageous to a lot of Baltimore residents, that there, if you look at sort of the timeline of the arrest, there doesn't seem to be any particular reason why he was taken into police custody, other than the fact that he looked at an officer the wrong way, and that, you know, that is an experience not uncommon to people in that part of Baltimore, and so there's that. I mean, just the fact that you can be arrested. You know, had Freddie Gray not died, he would have been booked, he would have been put in jail for essentially doing nothing. It's very disturbing to people. And then just the fact, and I think this should be disturbing to everyone, that someone arrested by the police was fatally injured in their custody. Even if Gray had done something to warrant an arrest, let's say he had stolen something, let's say he was selling drugs, whatever, it should still be disturbing to everyone that once in police custody, he suffered a severe injury that killed him.
Mm-hmm. You make reference to the fact that Baltimore is a largely black city. 63.7% black residents have turned their presence into black mayors, black city councils, black representatives to Annapolis. Black leadership in Baltimore is a given that even extends to police in Baltimore. So should we expect something different here?
You know, many of the problems with policing are more institutional than necessarily racial. And this, I think, gets lost in some of the broad conversation about it. But, you know, the fact that Baltimore has, a black police commissioner, many black officers, a lot of black leadership, doesn't mean that it's immune to sort of the institutional problems that I think have crept into American policing. In this particular case, I think that the fact that, you know, the state's attorney is African-American, that the mayor is, that sort of all of the power players are, creates a much greater sensitivity to what's happening on the ground, which can be very helpful and can be very useful. But, you know, broadly, I don't think we should fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, descriptive representation among relevant power brokers and leaders necessarily mitigates what are problems and sort of how we think of, conceive of, and conduct policing.
Mm-hmm. And then we have to look at this problem, and it's true of so many big cities in this country or medium-sized cities in this country. You talk about the neighborhood where Freddie Gray lived. Half of the residents, unemployed. One-third of the homes are vacant. 60% of residents have less than a high school diploma, and the violent crime rate is among the highest in the city of Baltimore. Obviously, this points to, again, as we've talked about so much, this huge disparity between those who have and those who don't have in this country.
Right. And as I argued in a piece, I think, on Wednesday or Thursday, a lot of that is traced directly back to how the city was constructed in its literal physical space. Beginning in the 1910s and kind of continuing for the next 50 years, there were deliberate plans and patterns of segregation, attempts to corral African-American residents and initially European immigrant residents, but later they could make their way out via upward mobility. Efforts to corral them into particular areas of the city and deny them access to assorted services. And so, you know, the fact that this was also initially done to European immigrants to the city is actually very, it helps us understand what happened. Those European immigrants, their children and their grandchildren could get access to a variety of services. They could essentially blend into mainstream society. After World War II, there was sort of a leveling of social status among white immigrant groups versus native-born whites, and that kind of helped them in Baltimore integrate. And you saw that. You saw sort of Polish and Italian immigrants and their children and grandchildren take more prominent roles in Baltimore city society. Those pathways out weren't really available to African-American residents, and so they, in effect, were kind of just stuck in the In these segregated neighborhoods, in these segregated areas. And this was never rectified. There was never a point where the state or the federal government or the city invested resources in trying to reverse this prior segregation. And so what we're witnessing now is kind of at the end of a long cumulative line of policy choices that have yielded material deprivation and poverty and have facilitated crime in a few concentrated areas of Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. What do we do as a country? Because if it's not Baltimore, it's Ferguson, it's in Florida, it's all over the country right now. What needs to be done, do you think, on a national level to keep these deaths at the hands of police from taking place in cities? Because, you know, you can imagine what happened in Baltimore happening in many other cities in this country if you have this kind of, you know, unarmed African-American death at the hands of police.
It's tough. You know, when it comes to specifically police relationships, there are steps the federal government can encourage, and that states and localities really have to run with. And those are a bit far-reaching. They include kind of, you know, like I said earlier, reevaluating how we police. Techniques like the investigatory stop, in which police officers make stops of cars or people based off of sort of a generalized suspicion that they may be involved in crime, can be effective in reducing criminal activity. But they also, because of the discretion involved in them, they end up mainly targeting African Americans and exerting a real cost on civic cohesion. So for a practice like that, you know, one thing governments will have to start thinking of is, you know, do we want to find some alternative to that that isn't so corrosive to civic trust and cohesion? Do we want to risk, you know, the consequences of that kind of routine police interaction between citizens?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, there isn't any single silver bullet here. It's sort of a real reevaluation of how we hold police accountable, how we think about the profession, how we think about policing. All these things have to come together to begin to make change. And so it'll be a long and difficult project, even if it's successful, or and even if there's sort of the political will for it. If there isn't, then it will be, an even longer, even more difficult slog.
And when you look at segregation of neighborhoods, when you look at the amount of unemployment, which is so high in Baltimore and other major cities among minorities, where is a political will to create some kind of work for people, and particularly people who don't have college educations, in some cases are not through high school? You need to, people have to have a purpose. They have to have a job, right?
Right. And I think if we're thinking sort of broad in terms of systemic problems, just we haven't really ever addressed the collapse of industrial economies, not just in inner cities, but sort of in a whole swath of places for Black and white Americans,
mm-hmm.
Where there just aren't jobs. And occasionally you'll hear commenters say that, you know, the problem in Baltimore or the problem in Appalachia or what have you is that there aren't enough middle class values, but it's awfully difficult to have middle class values when there are no middle class jobs. And so as a country, I think we need to think seriously about how we provide or how we create those jobs and what to do in places where the industries aren't coming back. But there are still plenty of people who need ways to support their families and, have a chance at upward mobility.
We certainly welcome the audience's thoughts about what's been happening in Baltimore. We're going to move to political news, but some of the political news surrounds what happened in Baltimore. Jamel has written some really interesting pieces. He references Hillary Clinton's impressive criminal justice speech, which was given last week, and indicates, he says, and I haven't really heard anybody say this before, that she is going to be looking at sort of the Obama coalition to rally for her. And we'll talk about that. We will talk about those who have entered the race today, Republicans who have entered the race today. Marco Rubio, you know, I was thinking last week that he seemed to be gaining quite a bit of support. And Jamel says it's not that Senator Marco Rubio can't win, but it's almost, he's almost no one's first choice for the job. We'll talk about Bill Clinton and why he says Hillary must turn her back on parts of her husband's political legacy in order to win in 2016. And we have a lot of other issues on the table as well. But today we had two new entries into the Republican field. Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon, African-American gentleman. Carly Fiorina, who's the former Hewlett-Packard chief executive, who positions herself as an alternative to Hillary Clinton. And Micah Huckabee is also entering the race. So the field gets pretty big, doesn't it? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We welcome your participation. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We'll go to your phone calls in a moment, but let's switch to politics for a moment with Jamelle Bouie. You wrote a piece about Hillary Clinton, her impressive criminal justice speech last week. And also, you said that Hillary Clinton, who believes she needed working class whites to win, is not a Hillary Clinton who would embrace the agenda that she outlined during that speech for police reform or use the rhetoric she used. She needs to reconstitute the Obama coalition to win, so she'll push forward on key issues for Latinos, young women, and Black Americans. What did she say that indicated that's what she is going to do?
I think it's just the entire approach of that speech. It was surprisingly far-reaching, especially given her husband's role in building the kind of policy infrastructure that has led to mass incarceration. And in the speech, she showed a lot of empathy for, you know, Black and Latino communities that face problems of police misconduct. And so just the tone and tenor of the speech makes me think that what she's trying to do is shore up her support with parts of the Obama coalition that are really integral. So, you know, in 2016, if Hillary Clinton can get similar turnout as Barack Obama among African Americans, that helps her win states like Virginia and Ohio pretty easily. And, you know, a map where Hillary Clinton wins Virginia and Ohio is almost certainly a map where she's won the presidency. So I think it's a shrewd strategy. And the reason why, you know, I focused on the speech as well is that I think people tend to believe that politicians and presidential candidates in particular are very insincere in their promises, and this speech had a lot of promises. But what the political science actually really strongly implies, or suggests rather, is that politicians try to fulfill their promises. And, you know, how much a politician tries kind of depends on the political importance and salience of that promise. And so the promises in the speech, like police body cams nationwide, are very big promises. They're very salient to her political odds. And so I think this is something she's serious about. And if she's elected president, the mere fact that she made the promise provides an opening to activists and other allies to pressure her on getting something done. So all in all, you know, from both the policy perspective and from the political perspective, I thought the speech was significant.
Hmm. Let's go to some phone calls for you, Jamelle. Scott in Columbus, our first caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. I wanted to make a comment about the Baltimore debacle.
Okay.
The cops have been beating up minorities for like 80 years. If they had cameras this whole time, then the amount of cases would be insane. The earliest one I can think of that's documented is Rodney King, but that was my only point. This is nothing new. It's been going on forever. Nobody got it on film before. That'd be all I have to say.
Thank you, Scott. Jamelle.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the thing that's changed. So I'll say two things. First, believe it or not, it's probably the case that there's less police violence than there was a generation ago. Policing is actually better than it used to be, and that includes in minority communities. So I think that gives you a sense of how bad it used to be and how much further we have to go. And sort of to bolster the point the caller made, this is almost certainly the kinds of things we've seen in Baltimore and in North Charleston, South Carolina with Walter Scott, or in Cleveland with Tamir Rice, are almost certainly more common than we think. The difference is that, you know, there is more surveillance, either from, you know, official surveillance, from cameras, from businesses and such, or just people's phones. I was in New York City, on Friday, just kind of walking from a subway stop, and I saw someone get arrested. I don't know the context of it. It looked like, insofar that the arrest can be ordinary, it looked like an ordinary arrest. But surrounding the arrest were people with their cell phones out recording.
Oh, really?
And I think that's just how people react to arrests now. If that's the case, then if there is misconduct, if there is something that seems fishy, you know, you're going to have video of it somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Gary is next in Madison. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to make a comment and then a question. I want to say why I'm ready for Hillary. The first point may be a little self-serving, but quite frankly, under the Clintons, when they were in the White House, I never made so much money as I did in my life. The economy was wonderful. Secondly, they're not killing kids on the sidewalks of Bosnia as a result of Bill Clinton's effort. And thirdly, he took Ireland, if you remember North Ireland, how war-torn it was, and now it's the most successful economy in Europe. So I'm really ready for Hillary. I'll tell you, I respect Obama. I voted for him. I supported him. But I sometimes wonder if Hillary had made it, if we wouldn't be in a little better situation than we are now. And the question I have is, why are women constantly sniping at her? Is it something of jealousy? I know a woman who went to Wellesley with her, and they said that, well, she was pretty snotty back then. But good Lord, she's a very smart woman. Are women jealous of that, or what's going on? I'll take your comments off.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for the call, Jamil.
I'm not sure I'm equipped to answer that question, but I will say that Hillary Clinton has, for basically the last 15 years, been among the most admired women in the United States. And if you look at her approval ratings, even now, or her favorability ratings, the strength comes from women. A majority of American women have a favorable view of Hillary Clinton. And so I think broadly among the public writ large, women don't really have a problem with Hillary Clinton at all. It's sort of in maybe particular context, and obviously conservative women, disagree with Clinton politically. But by all accounts, she's a very well-liked figure among American women.
Don't you think part of the problem is that some people, and maybe it's more women than men, I don't know, but it's interesting there's a sizable number of people within the Democratic Party who really like Elizabeth Warren, who evidently is counseling Hillary Clinton now, and she has taken some of her advice, which she hasn't done in the past, that people would prefer a more progressive Hillary Clinton.
I think that's true, but I also think that those people wouldn't necessarily attack Hillary Clinton. Even Elizabeth Warren doesn't attack Hillary Clinton. She kind of just says, effectively, I support Hillary Clinton, and I would hope that she and I would like her to embrace more progressive policies. But I don't really see any vitriol from that side of the divide.
Mm-hmm. And before we let's do one more story on the Clintons before we go away from them. You also wrote a piece about Bill Clinton, and there's a cost to flying with Bill Clinton. You also have to carry his baggage. What is his baggage, and what is the best strategy for using him in her campaign or not?
His baggage basically is that he hangs around with lots of extraordinarily rich people and tries to get their money for his foundation. And,
right.
The Clinton Foundation has done a lot of good work. It has, helped subsidize HIV/AIDS medication in sub-Saharan Africa. It's helped, on efforts to, eliminate malaria. It is a global force. On the balance, is a global force for good. When you're spending a lot of time with very wealthy people and trying to get their money, it just doesn't really look good. There's a reason why Americans aren't fans of sort of this era of super PACs and Citizens United and huge billionaires pouring lots of money into politics. It just doesn't look good. And so I think Hillary Clinton, when she left the State Department, ought have done more to distance herself from the foundation. Now, obviously, she could never fully disconnect herself from it. That is impossible. But I think she would have done well to just kind of not be connected with the foundation in an official capacity, mm-hmm. and to avoid kind of any appearance of impropriety that may come from the fact that her husband, is an influential man who spends, again, a lot of his time raising a lot of money from very wealthy people.
Right. And getting paid a whole lot of money for speaking to some of those people. $26 million, the guy could be a first baseman. He's got a salary for a Major League Baseball player, doesn't he?
That's right, yes. $500,000 speeches. I don't know the economics of speech giving. From what I understand, oftentimes, those speech events are also occasions for fundraising, so it's all kind of connected, but it just doesn't look good.
Right.
I think if I were running for office and I had and my partner was involved in that kind of thing, I would probably keep my distance just for the sake of appearances.
Mm-hmm. So now this Republican race, Jamel, just keeps getting lengthier and lengthier. Ben Carson announcing today, Carly Fiorina announcing today, Mike Huckabee is tomorrow or sometime today. I mean, you're going to have an incredible number of people on the Republican side. Is there anything that distinguishes Carson and Fiorina and Huckabee?
I think what distinguishes all three of them from sort of Bush and Rubio and Walker and even Cruz and Paul, Rand Paul, is that they have really no chance of winning. They're not serious contenders in the sense that they have a shot at winning the nomination. They are sort of what we'd call fringe candidates, message candidates who are there to either further their personal brand, raise their speaker's fees, sell books, who knows. But that's what they all have in common as far as distinguishing from themselves. I think Huckabee is distinguished from the other two just by virtue of the fact that he was a sitting governor for a very long time. He finished in sort of the top tier of presidential of candidates in the 2008 Republican primary. And even though he's been out of politics as a politician for the last 6 or 7 years, he does retain, some of that legitimacy. And so of the three, I'd say he is most likely to make an impact in the mm-hmm. race. But the other two are really their personalities, and it's hard to see what they bring to the table and what they're going to get out of all of this.
Mm-hmm. I think people underestimate Huckabee. He has kind of mastered the art of I'm speaking to you, much as Clinton did. He knows television now because he had his show. He's an affable guy. He's extremely conservative on issues, but he certainly has this I'm in this with you kind of persona, I think. Would you agree?
Oh, I agree. I think Huckabee is a very skilled retail politician, but sort of his problem is that what is he bringing to the table that someone like Walker isn't? The people in Iowa may love him, people in South Carolina may love him, but when it comes to the kinds of people who fund presidential elections and who give support, why him? Why mm-hmm. him and not someone who's been in the game for longer and more consistently? And who has a chance to unify disparate factions of the Republican Party.
And what about Senator Marco Rubio? What did you write about him? Why did you say that he's almost nobody's, he must be some people's first choice, but not a lot of people's first choice for the top job?
Yeah, Rubio has a similar, so Rubio's advantage is that he's young, he's charismatic, he's a good speaker. He's a Latino, and so he's a very new face of the Republican Party and those ways, and both in with his youth and his ethnicity. But when you're thinking of the, I don't like the term establishment because it's just too hazy, but when you're thinking of kind of the activists and the donors and the people who kind of ultimately determine the shape of a nomination race, Rubio is acceptable to all of them, but he's not really a first choice. The kind of the top donors and the most entrenched members of that establishment are for Bush. The people who are skeptical of Bush are for Walker. And Rubio in many ways is an alternative to Bush, less more so than he's an alternative to Walker. And so maybe if Bush stumbles, Rubio will rise. But kind of in the absence of Bush stumbling or Walker stumbling, it's hard to see how he makes headway. He's a second choice candidate. And that's not a bad place to be. Again, he's very young. If, let's say, Hillary Clinton wins next year, he's probably first up for the nomination in 2020. Mm. And if let's say he sits that one out, he's going to be among the top choices for 2024. I mean, he still has quite a time ahead of him to do well in presidential politics. But right now, there's no a particular reason why you would choose Rubio over the, two-term Wisconsin governor or the brother of a former president.
Mm-hmm. And what about the brother of the former president, Jeb Bush? He says that he is breaking fundraising records. Is he?
He is. He is on track. he's on track to raise a tremendous amount of money in this first quarter of 2015, much more than Romney did at the comparable point in 2011, or that McCain did in the comparable point of 2007, or that George W. Bush did in 1999. So he's going to break fundraising records. What's interesting about that is that, you know, usually a candidate who can raise that much money is so dominant within the party that he kind of discourages challengers. And there's a bit of a chicken of an egg problem here, right? Because, you know, did they raise that much money because they're so dominant, or are they so dominant because they raised so much money?
Mm-hmm.
But generally, you know, it's a very strong candidate will be able to raise a lot of money, which will discourage people from jumping in the race. Bush has raised a ton of money. He hasn't really discouraged anyone from jumping in the race. So I think what that signals is that he's probably a weaker candidate than we realize, that there's a large chunk, possibly a majority of the Republican Party, that just is sort of wary of taking a chance on another Bush. And so that gives an opening to candidates like Walker. It provides an opportunity to candidates like Rubio. I think that's part of the reason why so many people are jumping in, because they're essentially saying, you know, Bush isn't dominant, so why not?
We welcome more phone calls. Jamel Bowie is our guest for All Things Political today. He's Slate staff writer, and he writes very well about politics and policy and race. He spent some of last week in Baltimore and has written some thoughtful analysis of what's going on in that city and what happened with the announcement by the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, on Friday, announcing the results of Freddie Gray's autopsy and charging six of the officers, and why it is that so many of our big cities have minority communities that have huge rates of joblessness and vacant homes. Why don't we address that as a society? Do you think it should be the fodder of presidential rhetoric and action right now and in the presidential election that is coming up? We're talking about all of the people who've been entering the Republican race. Two more today, Mike Huckabee, either later today or tomorrow. We're talking about the Clintons and the baggage that Bill Clinton may have, and whether or not do you think that these investigations, the Clinton Foundation, the New York Times is going to be pursuing stories about their foundation. And, of course, that book is coming out this week. Do you think that there's a lot there? Do you think that it will distract from the focus of Hillary Clinton's campaign? We certainly welcome your calls. A couple lines are open, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. All Things Political this hour. Jamel Bowie, Slate staff writer, is our guest, and let's go to Willem and Colfax next. Hi, Willem.
Hi.
Hi.
Your guest mentioned something about if Walker should stumble, and I think, you know, I wonder what qualifies as a stumble, considering, you know, his comments about the peaceful protests and at the Capitol, the fake Koch brother call, the two times that he ran, you know, did pretty major things like the $300 million cut to the university that he never mentioned during his campaign, or the Act 10 in the campaign before, and the stumbles that he made in England, his not wanting to commit to an answer about climate change, or, you know, what qualifies as a stumble in the presidential election? I mean, to me, those are indications of someone that's not ready for the highest position in the land.
Jamel.
You know, a stumble, so all of those things are obviously not good for Walker, but they're not the kind of things that disqualify him. All sorts of candidates make comments or whatever that that aren't good for them. The 2008 primary on the Democratic side, I think, is a great example of this. Barack Obama made a bunch of different comments that just did not wear well among Democratic voters, among the general public, and ultimately they didn't end up hurting him. A stumble would be something major and in the spotlight that would suggest sort of some sort of troubling problem. So the classic example of this most recently is Rick Perry's debate performances in the 2011 Republican primary. On paper, Rick Perry was a great challenger to Mitt Romney. As a retail politician, he was quite effective. And so if you are someone looking for an alternative to Romney, those are two boxes you can check off. But in debates, he was awkward. He was stiff. He declared positions that kind of ran anathema. He ran positions that were opposed to where a lot of the Republican base was. And he, you know, made kind of these huge mistakes, including the famous, you know, I'm gonna get rid of three departments, and then he couldn't name the third one. And so that kind of thing, if you are a Republican power broker, if you're a donor, that's very troubling because it suggests that in the general election you might be caught flat-footed and you might end up losing something that could have been very winnable. Walker, as far as I can tell, hasn't made mistakes like that yet. If he does, then that would be a stumble and he may fade from the field. But it's a bit too early to tell at this point.
Well, you made mention and wrote a column about his position against legal immigration. Was that a stumble?
Not at all. I mean, that was him adjusting to where the Republican Party base is moving. A stumble would have been the opposite if he had, you know, announced, "Well, I'm going to support a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants." That would have hurt him. Even if it may sound sensible to, you know, a lot of listeners, but it would have hurt him among Republican voters. What I'm trying to think of things that would constitute a stumble for Walker, and it's kind of hard until you see it. But when you see it, you know that's what just happened. And so for now, I'd say Walker's on solid ground. The question is whether he can. The question really, it's not even anything about Walker. It's how much are Republican elites committed to Bush? If they kind of are, if they're half committed, then if Walker shows himself to be a competent and confident campaigner, if he ends up winning Iowa, doing well in New Hampshire, winning South Carolina, then he might break out as the likely nominee. If he kind of runs out of steam by the time Iowa comes around, then we can safely write him off.
Mm. You know, when you were saying that, I was thinking about commitment, and I'm wondering if we do get, which many think we will, another Clinton-Bush family running for the presidency. How committed do you think the American people will be to turning out at the polling place to vote in that election?
You know, I don't know. I think it might be higher than you. So it's like you have on one end you have kind of the, you know, heavy sigh of a Bush-Clinton election. On the other, you have real excitement about the possibility of the first woman president. And so turnout could end up being, you know, a little higher than it was in 2012. Maybe not as high as it was in 2008, but it could be decent. But I'm not really sure how it would look. I tend to think that the public is generally pretty partisan, and you know, anyone who wins a nomination ends up having a pretty decent chance of winning the presidency. And so I have to expect that turnout won't fall far from where it was in the last presidential election. But beyond that, I really can't, really not sure.
Right. Jane in Green Bay, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, you, Jane.
I have a few comments about Mr. Walker.
Okay.
I think the only thing competent about him is his lies. And if he keeps, a friend of mine keeps telling, I'm 74 and I've, you know, seen a lot of governors come and go. But if he keeps talking, sooner or later he's going to fall on his face. Because he's a liar. And the only master's degree he has is in pandering. So anyway, that's my comments, and I would appreciate hearing from your guest also.
All right, thanks very much. There, as you can tell, Jamel, from the calls, there's divided opinion about Scott Walker in this state.
Yeah, I can tell. I look at Walker, and I see someone who is a good politician.
Yes.
And potentially quite effective on a national level. He's, to some regards, very untested on that. We actually do not know how he would react against sort of a top-tier Democratic political talent. And that's sort of what presidential nomination races are trying to find out. The reason why you don't really see the kinds of landslides you saw in the 60s or the 70s is because the nomination processes have developed such that, you know, anyone who gets through it is going to be skilled enough and have enough of a campaign infrastructure to mostly, you know, blunt the advantages of their opponent. I don't think anyone really knows how effective Walker is going to be against someone like Bush or Rubio, who do have a bit more national national experience than Walker does. And no one knows how he's going to fare against Hillary Clinton. And so it's a bit of an unknown. My hunch is that he will end up being quite effective. I don't know if he'll win the nomination, but I definitely would put him in my kind of top three picks. Mm-hmm. But we'll see.
We haven't talked about Bernie Sanders. We were talking about all the Republicans entering the race. Senator Bernie Sanders, I understand that he raised $1.5 million in one day, and the average donation was something like $43.
That's right. And I think, you know, it's funny, compared to your mega donors, that's not much. But for, you know, an otherwise obscure socialist senator from Vermont, it's pretty great. You know, what's interesting about Sanders is that he's not really running against Hillary Clinton. He is running for a set of policies. Mm-hmm. And he's hoping that in getting support for those policies, he can push Clinton to the left. And I think my sort of sense that he's not running against Clinton comes from how he's reacted to the Clinton Cast book and sort of the questions around the Clinton Foundation. When asked if they were kind of a legitimate area of inquiry, Sanders deflected the question. He was like, I'm not here to talk about Hillary Clinton. I'm here to talk about, you know, my policies. I'm here to talk about Wall Street. And I think Sanders's approach will be that he's more likely to get, he's more likely to influence Hillary if he's not trying to, you know, harm her campaign as much as he's trying to, you know, convince her that it would be politically worthwhile to adopt some of his positions.
Let's go to Michael in Duluth. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Doing very well.
Good.
I just want to say first, Jamel, I read your column in Slate all the time. It's an honor to, I guess, have a conversation with you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
My question is regarding, I guess, the comments that you were making earlier about Secretary of State's speech about ending mass incarceration, what have you, and also addressing your comment about the collapse of the industrial economy. My question is that, you know, as you said, Hillary Clinton is trying to reconstitute the Obama coalition going forward for the presidential election. And my question is something along the lines of, you know, there was in the past, as you know, a New Deal coalition and a coalition that brought her her husband to power. If you look at the old 1992-1996 map, you know, he was winning states like Kentucky, West Virginia, Louisiana, Montana, Arkansas, of course. What strategies do you have, I guess, for Hillary Clinton to sort of, rebuild that old coalition? Because the problem that you generally see is that, you know, the Obama coalition shows up in great numbers for presidential elections and, you know, large general elections. But, you know, like in 2010 and in 2012, or sorry, 2014, they generally don't show up for midterm elections, which really harms the Democratic Party when it comes to governing, because they can't maintain majority coalitions. And that's, yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, that's again, thank you for reading. As far as kind of reconstituting the Clinton era or Bill Clinton era coalition, that's tough, because part of it is just demographics. When Clinton ran for president in 1992, the oldest cohort of voters were, in fact, New Dealers. And they were still very Democratic, and they voted in very large numbers. And so in places like West Virginia and Kentucky, you had these older white voters who were a large portion of the electorate and were really quite liberal. They were, in some regards, at least in terms of economic policy, probably a bit more liberal than younger voters. They have largely passed away. And our current cohort of older voters from, you know, roughly 50 to elderly voters – are people who came of political age, in the period after the New Deal, who are more conservative on balance. And it kind of, there's a bit of a seesaw if you look at kind of generational political profiles, that, you know, one generation would be quite liberal, the next one would be quite conservative, the other quite liberal, and so on and so forth. And so it might actually just be by virtue of that impossible to reconstitute the Clinton coalition, because you have just cohorts of white voters who are more conservative. Now, I do think that there are ways to kind of staunch the bleeding. I don't think it's preordained that Democrats are only going to win, 30% of white voters or some small percentage of the white working class. I think there are ways to appeal to those voters. The problem is that there are costs to all political actions. And so maybe if Hillary Clinton were more restrictionist on immigration, she could win back white working class voters in Ohio and Pennsylvania. But then she might be sacrificing Latino voters in Colorado and Nevada. Maybe if Hillary Clinton were, a bit tougher on welfare reform, she could win those voters, those white working class voters, but she might end up losing support among African Americans in like Florida and Virginia. So I can't think of a cost-free way to win back enough white voters to even approach reconstituting Bill Clinton's coalition. I do think one thing that may happen next year is that Clinton will peel off some older white women who maybe have favorable views of her, maybe supported her in the past, and would like to vote for a woman president. And so that effect, much in the same way that the Obama effect was, that there weren't just him winning a higher percentage of the black vote, which didn't really happen. He was roughly in line with most other Democrats. It was that there were just more black voters in total participating in the election. You might see, insofar that white women are some part of non-voters, you might see them come back into the electorate, which would boost up Clinton's numbers among white voters, and really, I think, shift the dynamic of the election. If she's winning, one or two percentage points more white women, that can translate to big gains in, the Midwestern states and some Southern states.
Michael, thanks for the call. One more call, Bruce in Deerfield. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good. I'll try and make this real quick. Okay. I'm trying to concentrate it in my mind, but the disturbing part about this conversation, and I sort of consider myself to be a conservative Democrat, whatever that is, but my frustration here is that I feel like the politics of being a politician, that is getting elected, really kind of gets in the way or cuts off election of people who really have thoughtful understanding of the problems of the country and hopefully therefore some ideas about what the solutions or directions for the betterment of the whole country might be. And a lot of the things that we deal with in the news cycle are really not the problems. They're really symptoms of the problems, and which essentially are ignorance and want. And but I don't know how you get from where we are now to a system or an engaged citizenry that would help sort those power, or how a politician who's got some brains to actually problem solve can get by somebody who's just a good politician.
Can you answer that in about 40 seconds, Jamel?
I don't think I can.
Well, do you want somebody who's really smart, who's got solutions? Is that a priority? Should it
that's
be?
That's a priority, and I think it should be, but I also think you should want people who are very good politicians. This is a long argument that I'm going to condense into 10 seconds, but I don't think it's an accident that our best presidents, Abraham Lincoln among them, have been astoundingly good politicians. I think there's a connection between those two things that we shouldn't dismiss.
Jamel, thank you so much for being with us. I love what you choose to write about it. And how you write about it. You're good. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jamel Bowie, he's a Slate staff writer. He covers politics, policy, and race. His piece is from Baltimore, where he was last week, well worth reading. But he just picks very interesting topics to write about, so he's worth following. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and to K.P. as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Stay with us for the next hour of our program. Two members of the Joe Hill 100 Roadshow will be joining us. They have kicked off their seven-month event last weekend, and they'll be in Wisconsin much of this week. We'll hear some music as well.